And on ABC Radio National, this is Artworks. Amanda Smith here with a feature for you that's a brush with the rich and famous. Forget that Arts Council funding application or trying to scrape together the rent for your artist-run space. Sarah Thornton's book, 7 Days in the Art World, is a journey from Venice to Basel to New York for some of the world's biggest, richest art events, the Biennale, the fairs and the auctions. Sarah Thornton is both an art historian and a sociologist, so she's interested in what drives the fabulously wealthy to buy art rather than more yachts or jewels, also in what the motivation of the advisors and dealers is, and how the art market changes depending on whether the economic times are good or bad. Deborah McCoy has been reading 7 Days in the Art World.
The hammer punctuates and passes judgment. It acts as a full stop to the end of every lot, but it's also a little punishment for those who didn't bid high enough. In the subtlest of ways, Burge dangles the carrot. This unique work of art could be yours. Isn't it beautiful? See how many people want it? Join the club. Enliven yourself. Don't worry about the money. Then in a blink, he hits everyone but the highest bidder with a stick, as if all the seduction and violence of the art market were represented in the rhythm of a single lot.
From 7 Days in the Art World, a description of Christopher Burge, Christie's chief auctioneer, controlling the room. Sarah Thornton's book was published after an extended art market boom with its attendant record prices, like $72 million US for a Warhol car crash or $33 million for another of Lucian Freud's Large Naked Women. That's not to say that records have disappeared with the financial crisis. Top prices were paid at the recent Christie's and Sotheby's contemporary art auctions in New York. Among them, $7.9 million for David Hockney's A Beverly Hills Housewife, painted in 1966. But the mood was different.
When you're in a boom market, the volume of art that gets pulled onto the stage of a public sale, like an auction, increases dramatically because there's a lot of competition for the works and the prices can escalate. During a bear market, what you see is a lot more works being traded privately behind the scenes for many reasons. One, people don't want to look like they're desperate for money. Two, people are worried about exposing the artwork to public sale. You need at least two bidders in an auction room, at least in theory, whereas behind the scenes, you only really need to negotiate with one buyer. And also, the auction houses are no longer giving guarantees, which is something that made sellers secure about putting prized works up for sale publicly. So, you know, right now, there's a huge shrinkage in the size of the sales and the prices as well. What we saw in New York a couple of weeks ago, amazingly, was a lot of record prices, but that's partly because there were artists who hadn't had their prices escalate during the boom and they were brought into those sales. So a large painting from the 60s by David Hockney got a record price for the artist at auction. And so when a rare, large, prized work with a great provenance comes up at auction, then it can still command a high price. And that was actually about one of five records at Christie's that night. And then there were also a couple at Sotheby's, too, for Martin Kippenberger, who is a kind of artist, kind of connoisseur's artist, and is those kinds of artists who are coming back to the forefront.
So is it, I hate to use the term, a flight to quality, but I will anyway. Are there elements of that in what you saw at the most recent auctions in Christie's and at Christie's and Sotheby's?
That's certainly how the auction houses would put it. I mean, I'm not somebody who uses the word quality without quotation marks because I'm never sure what it is. Quality for me is a socially determined thing. It's not something that exists in the work all by itself, even though I believe in art and I believe in great work. For me, it's always complicated by all the other factors. I think that rarity has definitely kicked in during this recession, so that artists like Warhol, who have a huge number of works, they could kind of feed the huge appetite of a boom market. Whereas in a bear market, you know, the fact that there are so many flower paintings and so many Jackies, and it makes the market feel queasy, and a lot of those things don't sell. So artists who are less prolific can enjoy more success during a bear market.
As well as auctioneers and collectors, Sarah Thornton interviewed more than 250 people for 7 days in the art world. And she had the most remarkable access to leading art museum curators and directors, like Sir Nicholas Sirota from the Tate. She spent time at the studio workshop of the Japanese critical pop artist Takashi Murakami, and with curators for his big solo show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. She talked to editors and publishers at Art Forum magazine and got to sit in on one of the California Institute of Art's grueling critique sessions, where students line up for the all-day, all-night intensives designed to give feedback on their work. And she had entree to the world's largest prestigious art fair at Basel, Switzerland.
As he did his rounds, he praised dealers in French, cracked jokes in gesticulating Italian, and maintained an even warm tone in German with an irate dealer who didn't like the location of her stand. I believe I even heard him say shalom. Keller seems to possess all the best qualities of the multilingual Swiss: modesty, neutrality, internationalism, and an instinct for quality.
In Basel, as Sarah Thornton describes it, 100 private jets can touch down in just 24 hours. The fair is about seeing, selling, buying and networking. And if you can slip in early, before the official opening, to see what's on offer and maybe negotiate a pre-rush deal, all the better. Is there any truth, or was there any truth, to the rumour that a leading private advisor had actually disguised himself, gone to extraordinary lengths to disguise himself to get into the Basel Art Fair?
Yes, you're talking about Philippe Segalot, who is one of the most powerful art consultants in the world, and one of his key clients is François Pinault, who owns Christie's and has a huge museum in Venice. So he's kind of a collector, curator, dealer. Pinault is anyway. But yes, so Segalot, he represents a lot of money, power, and very serious collectors too. And I do believe it's true that he did disguise himself. I have never seen him in disguise myself, but I have seen a few BlackBerry photos. Philippe will not acknowledge this, of course, but he couldn't, could he?
Sarah Thornton has a degree in art history and a PhD in sociology. She spent 5 years inhabiting the contemporary art world to produce her book. And she uses the skills of the ethnographer, close observation of the participants, coupled with lots of qualitative interviews.
This 7 chapters in this book, the 7 days in this book, are distilled from, 5 years of very intensive, immersive research. You know, my choice of details, the ones I chose to include, are usually driven by the way they reveal the social structure or the cultural patterns or the institutional frameworks, rather than just through a kind of name-dropping motivation. I mean, one of the quotes that people often pick up on is, I'm talking to a collector about the auctions, and she says, well, you cannot wear Prada because you might get mistaken for a Christie's member of staff. And on the one hand, okay, it's like snooty and name-dropping, but on the other hand, it really revealed her whole social world to me. when she said that. It was really eye-opening moment. I thought, oh my God, you mean Prada's not the top? And, you know, so I think that, you know, there are lots of references to those kinds of things like clothes, you know, and for me, it's not a superficial thing. It's actually a very important social indicator and it's quite self-conscious one on the part of the people in the art world, not just the high-end collectors, but the artists themselves, you know, by the same token who would never be seen in certain designer brands because, you know, they need to be wearing grubby T-shirts and jeans.
Well, as you said,
even if they can afford it, you know, like John Baldessari, who's like now an artist with some of the best galleries in the world who and whose work sells solidly at auction, but you bump into him at the Art Basel in Switzerland and he's wearing slightly stretched out lime yellow T-shirt and crumply, slightly dirty trousers. But anyway, you know, it's we all announce who we are and the art world is very much about these roles and the way people inhabit those roles can be fascinating.
Well, you mentioned John Baldessari and that question of roles, and you spoke to him at the art fair, the Basel Art Fair, which is famous and legendary. I'm wondering if you can just recall what he told you about the idea of the artist being at Basel at that time.
Yes. I mean, he has a very funny quote that he says that an artist entering an art fair is like a teenager barging into his parents' bedroom while they're having sex. The alarmed expressions on the parents' faces say, "What are you doing here?" And that is the case. It can be very stressful for a dealer to have his artist on the stand. I mean, a lot of artists do actually go to the fairs, but it takes some getting used to handling it. A lot of artists say that they find going to an art fair depressing because there's too much art in the world and they feel dwarfed by it. I guess it's a bit how writers feel when they go into a bookshop. But there is a certain ideology within the art world that artists shouldn't be contaminated by commerce and that art shouldn't be contaminated in that way. And I mean, I tend to agree that we go to art because we hope it is made by people with motivations other than pure profit. You know, profit can be part of it and playing with the market can be part of it. But you hope somewhere that this is different from design objects, that there is a kind of deeper search and a deeper motivation behind the work. And I think that's why a lot of very rich people turn to collecting art rather than more yachts and cars and homes, because they're seeking a kind of deeper meaning in their lives, and art can help them find that.
Does that mean, Sarah, that they want to have contact with the artist, that they somehow want to share in an understanding of what the artist is doing, to somehow have an intellectual engagement with the artist that is over and above the acquisition of that work?
I think some collectors are very keen to have relationships with artists, but others are very happy just dealing with the work and sometimes are a little scared to meet the artist just in case they don't like them. So I think there are two kinds of collectors out there. I mean, I think either way, art can operate as a form of religion insofar as it is a kind of alternative form of intellectual, spiritual endeavor. And also it offers community in a way that churches can offer community. So with or without the firsthand interpersonal contact with the artist, I think that even the art object itself can offer intellectual stimulation. And it's a very personal thing.
My passion is really contemporary art. But I think collecting is a very private thing. And it's private and in a way it's very selfish because public can't really see it.
John Kaldor is one of our best-known collectors and art patrons. His passion for collecting really began in the early 60s when he bought a small Roy Lichtenstein.
Well, initially I started to collect Australian art, but then I had the ability to travel on business to the States and to Europe, and it was just then that pop art really exploded on the scene. And Lichtenstein was one of the originators of pop art. And it was just so exciting and so immediate and so different that I was really taken by it. And, I mean, it's really quite interesting, that's again in the early 60s, that a painting by John Olson or Ian Fairweather was more expensive than a Lichtenstein or an Andy Warhol or a Rauschenberg. So I started to collect those artists who were just being promoted or shown in commercial galleries then, very small works, because that's all I could afford. I mean, after all these years, I have built up a good connection with many commercial galleries. I know a lot of the museum directors and curators in New York and in London, and I keep in touch with them. And I just keep looking. The more you look, the more you, I suppose, understand, and the more you learn. It's like anything else. If you want to be a good golfer, I suppose you have to practice golf and play golf very often. If you want to understand art, you have to look at it a lot.
Last year, John Kaldor donated the bulk of his collection to the Art Gallery of New South Wales. At $35 million, it was the largest single gift to an Australian institution. This is the Artworks feature on ABC Radio National and online, looking inside the contemporary art world today with the writer Sarah Thornton, who makes a distinction between the art market, that is the dealers, collectors and auction houses, and the art world, the artists, critics and curators. And while it's not unusual for collectors, like John Kaldor, to donate large parts of their collections to galleries, what's the effect going the other way? For example, a big solo exhibition at one of our leading public institutions, how does that affect an artist's commercial standing?
Although you can intellectually separate the art world and the art market, and you could point at any one individual and say they were more or less part of one or the other, they are in practice very hard to separate. And the whole process of validation or legitimation that museums bring to artists' work is an essential part of the way the art market also values their work. So what you'll often find, especially when you look at New York, is when an artist has a solo retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art there, then their prices jump hugely, almost overnight. Or exposure at the Venice Biennale. Being the talk of the Venice Biennale will immediately impact on sales at Art Basel.
And what about art prizes? You had access to the nominated artists for the Turner Prize, the big Tate Prize that gets national television coverage. I think you even, in the book, put a dollar figure on it, what a win, a Turner Prize win, might do to an artist's sell prices.
I don't think I put a dollar price on it, but I think maybe one of my interviewees did. I mean, it probably depends on the economic climate, but prizes like the Turner Prize will catapult an artist out of obscurity into a certain kind of limelight. And exposure is linked inextricably to the holy grail of recognition. You know, what motivates an artist more than anything else? It's recognition. And of course, artists define this in completely different ways, very personal ways. You know, sometimes they just want to be recognized by that handful of peers that they went to art school with. You know, other times they want the recognition of a major institution. The Turner Prize is probably the best known and maybe most successful prize in terms of gaining exposure for its artists. It's much copied. There are a lot of prizes in museums in different countries that have modeled themselves in different ways on the Turner Prize. And I think the way that they announce the four nominees, have an exhibition in which each of the four artists is given a room within the museum, and ask the public to judge for themselves, and then have a jury who makes a decision, that whole process actually pulls in outsiders into what is really very much part of the art world, which is this process of passing judgment. You know, one of the ways that I was able to write this book was that I myself did my best to refrain from passing judgment, because the art world is a kind of Venn diagram of squabbling subcultures, many of whom don't get along at all. And in order to walk through those different subcultures and spend days with them, I really had to refrain from judgment. And the thing is, the art world is full of judgment all the time. It's kind of its modus operandi. And so something like the Turner Prize, it kind of invites general museum goers to participate. And so I always find the Turner Prize fascinating. It has its high exposure years and its low exposure years. But overall, I think it's done a lot for bringing contemporary art to a general public. Mm-hmm. And I'm a populist in that regard. Mm-hmm. I love contemporary art, and I find it enriching and fulfilling. And I think there's a growing audience for contemporary art, and I hope the book is part of that growing process.
Throughout the book, you asked some very straightforward, quite basic questions like, what is an artist? What is art? Which I think is probably a fairly bold move in when you're talking about a world where people will use terms like situational interventions or criticality or psychodynamic splitting. What did you come up with when you asked questions like, what is art and what is an artist?
Well, often I was met with a high degree of hostility. And when I was walking around certain sectors of the art world, particularly out in LA, I decided I would situate my art school chapter out in Los Angeles because there are a lot of really vibrant art schools there, and the artist community kind of revolves around them. And it seemed to be the key to understanding Los Angeles as an art world. I was wandering around there in particular saying, what is an artist? And, you know, I had students tell me I couldn't ask that. I had, you know, senior people whose names I can't tell you, tell me I was stupid. And so I really thought, well, maybe this is a taboo. You know, maybe I'm actually really violating something, because there was anger in the reactions to this innocent question. There were a lot of people who also gave me wonderful answers of many, many different kinds. And I think there is a tautological process. So what is art? Art is made by an artist. And that is really the only consensual definition that I could come up with in the end. Now, how do you become an artist is a different question altogether. And although there are a few people out there in the world who may just claim to be an artist, and who can stop them, and I'm sure they are artists, in general, in order to be a kind of real card-carrying member of the art world, you need to have gone to art school. And this is part of the professionalization of the artist's role, which happened kind of through the 60s and 70s. And now, if you go to any group show in a museum and you look at the CVs of the artists under 40 in that show, you will find not only do they have a BA degree from an art school, but they probably have an MFA, or Masters of Fine Art. And the Masters of Fine Art has become the kind of first benchmark of validation in order to be able to claim that you're an artist and therefore stamp whatever you make as art. There are a few exceptions to this, but they are few and far between. I mean, ironically, there's always exceptions that prove the rule. I mean, that's a wonderful thing about the art world. It is a world of exceptionality. And it embraces the exception, and part of the kind of one of the rules of the art world is that you're supposed to break the rules. Often I think there's a lot more rule tweaking than actual rule breaking, but it is an official rule, no matter how it's executed or interpreted.
And Sarah Thornton's book is called 7 Days in the Art World, an up-close and personal account of the rule makers and breakers in contemporary art, a world that, let's face it, most of us will only ever get to read about. Sarah Thornton was speaking from London, where she's based at the moment, with Deborah McCoy. And 7 Days in the Art World is published by Granta. Details for it are on the Artworks website. I'm Amanda Smith, and this is Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.